Yeah, for a company that just changed its name, changing your stripes is not easy. So now, Meter Group, formerly Decagon, and I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Neil Hansen and Dr. Brian Hopkins at Brigham Young University. One day I got a call from Neil, who's a good friend, and he said, you know, we just lost our irrigation system for a weekend here, and we've got our special stadium turf growing in our turf farm, and it's all dead now. Can you help us? So it was a great opportunity to me. I love to jump into these projects with friends, and we started thinking, how can we put together a system to try to warn everybody with a text message or something if the irrigation system goes down? It was on Memorial Day weekend 3 years ago, and everybody was off having a good time, and the irrigation system took a few days off too, and that was a problem. So we were just wondering what kind of technologies could we throw out there. And I want to just step back with you guys for a second. We talk about some cool research stuff here, but most of the world, if they sat in this room, would just be like, what are you guys doing? I mean, seriously, what are you talking about? And have no idea. I want to look at something lots of people are familiar with, something like this. This is a vacation home. I installed in this home a thermostat that's Wi-Fi enabled, okay? And so last night, got on the web, went and downloaded this. I could do it right now if I don't have time, but this is what's going on at the home. You know, it's 55 degrees, heat's not on. That's a good thing because people don't want to pay for it. There's the weather there in the location, New Meadows, Idaho. And I can even control it. If I wanted to heat it up right now, if I'm heading out there, I wish I was, but I'm not. But if I was going there, then I'd turn the heat on, okay? And here are the data in the house. It's got a temperature sensor right there on the thermostat. It's also got the outside temperature there, and it's also measuring temperature throughout the house. There's the Hillcroft is the name of the house, the basement temperature, the upstairs temperature, and then look in the living room. It sends me an email every week and saying, your living room sensor is out right now. You've got a problem. This is what the rest of the world is seeing, and this is what the rest of the world's going to be expecting from us as scientists in the agronomic area in the future. They want to have data at their fingertips. And while temperature and motion data that I just showed you from that system is fairly easy to produce, we just talked here this morning, this discussion on crop water stress index. How do we pull these data we can gather, like a IR image or a soil moisture piece of information, how can we actually make that actionable? Because in my house in New Meadows, I don't want to think about what the furnace is doing, right? I do want to know how much I'm paying for it, but I don't want to get into all the ins and outs of that and how it's all measured and doing those things. But I do want to make sure I don't spend a lot of money on that. And in the wintertime, it's expensive there. So I want to be able to solve this. This is the same problem we as scientists in the study of the soil plant atmosphere. We're trying to solve this. And if we don't solve it in an adequate way right now, there are plenty of other people, if you haven't noticed, who are trying to solve this problem and don't necessarily understand what they're trying to solve, so the solutions are not going to be great. So in the future, it's my vision anyway that the technology is going to push science and to produce and commoditize sensors and understanding that satiate a need for knowledge. If you haven't noticed, we're pushing forward this need to knowledge, to have this knowledge, and we got to go with them. We got to be able to help them understand what's going on. So with this project, we wanted to put together some pieces here to see if we can learn a little bit about how to help people understand, at least in this turf grass that I'm going to be talking about, how to control turf grass moisture well. And I'll apologize for whatever reason some of my titles slip behind the graphs and stuff. You're going to see it in another slide. Sorry, it says MRC, so soil moisture release curve. Many of you are familiar with the soil moisture release curve. Those of you who are not, let me talk to you about this, because this is really critical for us to turn data into information. In fact, we talked about that with the last speaker in the questions. This is a curve where on the on the y-axis here we have volumetric water content. You're going to see this again later, so remember this. Water potential is on the x-axis. Of course, it's a negative value. As it goes more negative, that's drying. And then I've plotted two different soils here, and these are just for illustrative value. because I want to talk about some things about water and soil that we can talk about. When the water is above a certain value, and those of you who are soil physicists will debate this later, let's poke a value in there above maybe negative 20 kPa. Water is free draining. That's water that plants are not going to use. It's not going to stay in the root zone. It's going to go beyond the root zone. And whatever is in that water is also going with it. It's a concern many of you are familiar with. And when we irrigate above that value, that we're just giving water away. Now, there's a range that we can talk about. We call that the plant available water. And I made a nice range down to negative 500 kPa there. Again, a nice debatable value. And something we can talk about is with different crops. But let's just poke it there and say that's the range in which the water can the plants can freely get water out of the soil. Now, as it dries, of course, that's more and more difficult and becomes less optimal. But that's a decent range that we can talk about that water is available. Then we have this range below which really water is no longer available. Still quite a bit of water in one of those soils, but that water is no longer available to plant water uptake. Now, why am I taking you through a moisture release curve? What does that matter in terms of plants? Well, a lot of people kind of look at this on the one side, look at this on the other side, and I want to say that together, the water content and the water potential combined actually create a picture for us that's really critical. And so, because let's look at this for a second. At a water content value of up around, I don't know, 28% here, both of these soils reach their drained upper limit there. The water's drained out there. Come back here. And then as we go lower, we can see a couple of things, that the lower boundary for where water becomes available in these two different soils is vastly different. So we basically have a reservoir of available water for this one soil, that upper soil, that's approximately half that of the other soil. Now, if we were just measuring water content, or if we were just measuring water potential, we really wouldn't understand this. And that's a critical parameter to understand. We're getting better with sensors and with measurements these days. And one of our questions was this experiment we were doing out on the turf plot, we wondered, hey, can we only measure this moisture release curve in the lab? Because if we can, we're going to have to take some samples from the field, put it in the lab, make these curves, and then somehow drive our measurements in the field to understand this available water, how much is there, and at what energy level is there. And that's a challenge. It's a good way. I encourage you all to do these things, but I wanted to know, can we do it in the field as well? So, and here's my other graph where things didn't go very well. Our question was, can in situ water content and matrix potential sensors generate an adequate moisture release curve? This has been done a little bit in the literature, not much. I actually saw a session here a couple of days ago that was talking about this. First time I've seen this. In the literature, there's not good agreement, and the range of water potentials is really, really limited. So we wanted to create a data set that was wide enough so we could really understand what are the limits of this, can we do this, and what are the results. And we also were out there saying, okay, as long as we're out here, we're trying to measure stuff, what if we did some kind of remotely sensed value? We took NDVI, had some NDVI sensors, and said, can we also sense stress in this turf grass with NDVI sensors with spectral reflectance? We also tried a PRI sensor, a photochemical reflectance index. I thought it would be better at this because it actually gets it at the xanthophyll cycle when we start shunting light away from photosynthesis into non-useful processes in the plant. Those data look really bad. I'm not even going to show you those right now. We're still trying to scratch our head and see what's going on there. But we just used NDVI as a surface measurement. So this, again, Brigham Young University turf farm. We had told you about the irrigation failure. We wanted a failure warning, and we wanted irrigation water optimization. And we wanted to try to figure out, could we optimize the water by putting sensors out there and figuring out, is there a possibility of machine learning or really learning by the sensors what's going on in the system, and then have no soil scientists show up and say, hey, here are the limits that you want to do. and cut me out of the equation. So we have two plots. I'm going to show these to you as we go along. Just remember there's a north plot. That's the stadium turf soil. So this is has a special engineered mix of soil. Both of them do, but that's the one that creates that beautiful BYU turf. If you ever watch them, their football team play. The south plot's more of a residential type turf. You can see what happens when things don't get watered adequately. You can see the color difference between the north and south plots there. So we went out on a nice Friday morning, spent some time installing sensors. What we did is co-locate sensors. This is a solid matrix water potential sensor, and we co-located it with a volumetric water content sensor. So water potential, water content, 6 centimeters, again at 15 centimeters, and then we installed just a water content sensor at the boundary layer between this engineered soil mix, a sand clay mix, and the clay loam was native soil that it was laid down on, around 30 centimeters. Our root zone was, we went out and actually looked at this, it was about 0 to 15 centimeters, which is typical for one of these managed turf grasses. So there we are installing it on that fine hot Friday afternoon. And now I'm going to throw a little data at you, but don't get too concerned. I'm going to actually look at these periods individually. But what I want you to look at first is just the overall picture of what went on during the summer a couple of years ago when we were doing this. We've run it every year. We did it working through it again this year. But I want to show you this data set because it's quite nice. This is kind of our calibration of what we were trying to do. So here's the calendar-based irrigation. I want you to familiarize you with what I'm talking about here. Volumetric water content over here is 0 to about 40%. Here are the 6 and 15 centimeter sensors, and here's the 30 centimeter sensor right here. And over here we have the matrix potential, 0 down to what many people say is permanent wilting point, negative 1500 kilopascals. And those two sensors at 6 and 15 centimeters are right up here. So that's what you're looking at. So we did three different regimes, essentially. We just installed the sensors and said, you do whatever you're doing, keep it going. That's what we call the calendar-based irrigation right here. Then we actually went and physically did some work on this. Neil Hansen spent some afternoons just out there kind of tweaking the system. And he would turn it on and off so that we would start to get some dry down, start to get some change in water potential and get it to work in the range that we thought was plant available. And then finally, we tried some drying. So we actually dried until there was no water uptake in the plants to see how low does it go, when do we see this point when the plants don't take up water anymore. So I'm going to show you each one of these individually. I'm also going to show you the NDVI. I wish this had more information in it, at least that I can see. And we've done a lot of smoothing of the data. There's a lot went into here. You can broadly see the buildup of the canopy. You can kind of see where nothing really changed over the fixed drying period. And during the drying to failure to dormancy, you can see decreasing. So if you squint a little, you can see it, but I don't think there's a lot of I was hoping it would be like, hey, you need to irrigate, and it definitely wasn't that. So I'm going to show you data on there, but I'm focusing in on the soil part right now. So again, I've labeled them here, the 6, 15, and 30 centimeter water content. We have the 6 and 15 centimeter water potential, and this is during the standard irrigation, the calendar irrigation cycles. And so what we're seeing is this every 2 day irrigation here, and they did something called syringing during the day between irrigation events where they're just trying to wet up the soil and make sure that the plants don't wilt. And what we can see, just a couple things. Number one, every time we irrigated, first of all, the water content at the 30 centimeter range, it jumped. We know we're getting water below the root zone, and we never changed the water potential. So not surprisingly, this is over irrigated. And so we have at least an example of, hey, we can make a difference here. So now we can talk about the initial dry down. This is a fun place to work because on a turf grass, very controlled, we've got a pretty nice soil to work in that has quite a bit of coarse material in it. And so you can't really do better than this in terms of nice, easy to judge water content decreases every day. So here we are, every day the turf is taking up water, and then at this point we irrigate it again. So this is a 6 centimeter right in the middle of the root zone. This is 15 at the bottom of the root zone. And the cool thing is that here at the beginning of this, we actually irrigated and we did change that 25 or 30 centimeter sensor. We were already very wet, but here we irrigated and we didn't change it. And so this gave us an idea of maybe what's the upper limit. Now this is me kind of tweaking it. I'd love to be able to do machine learning in here to figure out when this happens, but there's a lot of people behind the curtain kind of pulling the strings here. And so we have an idea of what that upper limit where we don't actually get water below the root zone at 30 centimeters, and we're going to say that's about 16% volumetric water content or meter cube per meter cube. And I'm going to come back to this value in just a minute. NDVI, not super interesting. We'll just say that and move on. It was decreasing a little bit during this time period for reasons that I don't think we had any stress at this point. So here's that drought period I mentioned right at the end where we said, okay, we're shutting off the water. You got a great place to do this, unlike Alabama, right, that it kept raining. In Utah and where I'm from in Washington during the summer, it simply doesn't rain. So we don't have any problem creating, well, I shouldn't say that. Now with global climate change, it probably will rain all the time, but it hasn't done. And so what we can see here in our irrigation, we irrigated here. The water potential shows us just starting to drop down in here. And by the way, I didn't mention that in the last slide. Can I go back up? Yeah. So the water potential's here. We finally started affecting that. We went down to about negative 400 kPa. The plants didn't seem to be affected by this. And then our irrigation event turned it back up close to the maximum water potential. So in the drought, we see each day the turf grass taking up water, and then along about right here, 5th of September, it stops taking up water. So there's that point. We know we got about that 15% moisture. That's looking good. Here, we stop taking up water. What's this point at the 6 centimeters? Well, we can draw a line over. That's around negative 500 kPa. That's the really bad point. We don't want to manage our turf grass to negative 500 kPa because that's going to cause problems. But we know that there is a lower limit that we can now see in these curves. Now you see the NDVI. We see a gradual trend down, but nothing that would have alerted us to, hey, you've got a problem on your turf grass. So how do we take this sensor information to or sensor data into information? So again, I'm returning to the moisture release curve, the MRC. So we have water potential here, and we have volumetric water content here. I took all the data we collected during the summertime. We took out the wetting events because the two sensors don't respond at the same speed. The water potential is slower than the water content, which is almost instantaneous. I went to some standard moisture release curve models at Campbell and Shiozawa for silt loam, loamy sand, sandy loam, and I just plotted these here. Those are just straight out of the literature from data collected by others. And then these dotted, all the dots here are the two plots. There was a north plot and a south plot at should be 6 centimeters there. And then I just plotted those here. And so what I wanted to do is say, without me touching the data, if we just plotted those data straight off the sensors, can we make a moisture release curve that tells us something? And I don't have a comparison here, but they actually matched up well with the lab data we had. But the interesting thing I found here was, here's the particle size distribution, sand, silt, and clay percentages for each of those plots, and the texture classification. And interestingly enough, the sandy loam was that south plot. That's that one right here. Let's go back so you can see it. So this is the north plot right down here, and the south plot right here. And from the textural classifications, we came close. I mean, as close as I could hope for in terms of estimating what the soil type was. So interesting. Next, what about this decision making in terms of how much water should go on or how we should control irrigation water here? Well, if you remember, I said about 16% was the upper limit where we didn't get water washing down through. And we saw that negative 500 kPa was about the lower limit where we really should never go beyond. That would cause problems for the turf grass. So with the 15-centimeter deep root zone, that's what we measured, we can do a little calculation in terms of, you know, meter cubed per meter cubed. We know that got XY unit volume and then a Z, that's 15 centimeters. You can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation. And what we know from that information now is that the maximum irrigation we should ever put on is 12 millimeters. So you say, well, how much should you put on? Well, not more than 12. At least that's what we know now. And we can start honing this information in, because you should not put on more than this water is a great start for people who put on a lot more than that water. And we already know that that happens quite a bit. So let me go just to a summary. Co-located in-situ sensors can provide similar moisture release curves to the lab. That's what one thing we learned, and there's a lot of information in that. In-situ moisture release curves provide independent information on both soil type and irrigation requirements, meaning that maybe we don't have to go to the field all the time to check this out. And unfortunately, remote sensing NDVI was difficult to interpret in terms of a stress indicator. I would say that was a no-go. So what is the future? So we loved this so much, we made 27 plots to control irrigation and water, and we're measuring how much water we're actually applying. Now we have, as we've talked about, our thermal measurements out there. We got thermal cameras. We've got still NDVI because we haven't given up entirely on that hope. We've got ET stuff. We did in the other project. We just didn't talk about it. And we still have to do some of this machine learning. So that's all I have for you.
Yeah. Or maybe we just need on and off sensors or some resistivity sensors, something that will give us a clue, not the precise measurement.
So that's...
And then the price will be dramatically lower, and then people can use it. No.
Yeah, so your question is, hey, what if we didn't need the accuracy of like a sensors we're talking about here, right? And maybe we could just use even the traditional electrical resistivity. We saw one a couple of days ago, I think Ryan Stewart talked about one of these $5 Arduino sensors, which is just a resistivity sensor. So it's possible. So the harder thing is, of course, the water potential side. You know, what are we going to do there in terms of what are the limits? These are things that I'd like to investigate as we go along. How can we push the limits of sensors? And the other side of this is, what about the systems? We talked about a system here just in one of the talks where we're putting together Arduino systems to try to figure out how to get the communications out. As I look at this problem, there are a lot of pieces to the problem. How to make the measurements in the field, how to get them from point of measurement to point of use, and then how to create interfaces with people like my Ecobee thermostat that really give us the information that we want. And I want to try to really consider that problem in the whole and then start poking at your ideas. Hey, what if we shift this parameter? What if we push the soil moisture monitoring sensor down in price? But when we think about that, I also don't want to undersell our science and what we've been able to do. You're one of the great sensor people, Naftali, and you know a lot about this, but there are many who would step up to this bar and say, hey, I can measure this, and start making bad measurements. And the truth of the matter is, you see them on the internet. If you look, go out and search soil moisture sensors, they're all over. And the challenge is how to know the difference and when we have a quality measurement. And that's where we as scientists come in and have to. That's what I started saying. We've got to inform this discussion before it gets to the point where people throw out. If people start using this Arduino sensor, I saw a blog on it the other day, and they were like, well, I tried to control my little bean plant in my window, and it was an utter failure. You know, and I'm coming to the conclusion that having better quality sensing data and as low tech, low power, low cost telemetry is really the way to go. And because the sensing is the key, that however we get the data back, we can do that cheaply. So that's what I've concluded, for what it's worth.
Just
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
What is specific in that sense? Or you can use the hyperspectral brain itself.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Of course, so the point is, hey, there are other indices you could use besides NDVI. First of all, NDVI was not a great test here. The problem is that it was really worse with our PRI than our NDVI, and that was the one I was counting on. And there's like water stress index is one of them. And then why not put out just a spectral. A spectroradiometer or something to actually do all of these and see the correlations. And we just haven't gotten there. This was something this was literally an experiment we put together on a Friday afternoon. I called back to Meter Decagon and said, hey, can you send me these instruments overnight? Because we want to install them. And this is, how much we put in, we got a lot out of it. And now you can see we're going to do a whole bunch more. So great point. And we ought to put a spectroradiometer, something out there to do a little bit better to see what. Exactly. Yeah. We got to go above the visible. Yeah.
Any more questions?
You mentioned you divided the areas of water availability into three zones.
Yeah.
Emphasizing the zone of high water content as the drainage zone.
Yeah.
I would like to say that under drip irrigation, one of the advantages of drip irrigation is that it can use the water from saturation up to or down to field capacity.
Right.
So it is not a zone to be neglected.
Measurement. Thanks, yeah, absolutely, I can't speak so wantonly, especially when we talk about drip irrigation. The nuance of that is a little challenging to explain to some. Absolutely. When we're using a drip irrigation, you're counting on that as we're not just covering the entire landscape with water. We're actually already doing quite a bit of water conservation right up front. So that's a great point. That region can be used if you irrigate correctly. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that.
Any other questions? John?
Can you maybe extrapolate from how much time? That's what a person might look at, say, at the thermostat. How much time do I have to change?
Right. So you're asking maybe about a derivative question, essentially. Can we take a derivative of looking at that decay and say, in like a green, yellow, red maybe, or hey, you got problems or you're out of luck? Yes, exactly. I haven't done a lot of, trying to take the next step and really put that into a modeling aspect maybe to try to figure out how to do that, but that really is the next step. That when we start talking about how to use this, we got to start about talking about spatial distribution. How do we put a few sensors out there and try to make estimates of whole fields? How do we put this into framework where we start to know, what's going to go wrong before things go wrong, right? And before we run out of water, because one of those days looked great. As I was showing you the water going down, the water was really well used on that day, and the next day it was flatlined, right? And so that was a problem. So kind of a look ahead to really create an experience in terms of what is going on in the soil. So that's all, that's next. That's where we want to go, in addition to really dealing with the other two legs of the stool, which are atmospheric. What's going on in the ET, and I didn't show you any of that. That should have been a part, but still, even trying to finish off that portion of it, and of course the crop water stress index idea, the thermal imaging. So got to do that too.
Any more questions for Colin? Okay, let's get to my hand.